And thank you for joining me again for another week of interviews. My name's Pete Bianco. I'm your host. And today's guest is Cheryl Nielsen. And Cheryl, could you tell us a little bit about your background?
Yes. I've got a degree in chemistry from Purdue University, and I was a certified quality engineer. I worked in industry, in pharmaceuticals, personal care, plastics, ceramics, running quality laboratories, and doing production line troubleshooting and things of that nature. I'm semi-retired, doing a little bit of farming, and that's how I ended up with an interest in HR 875.
And today you'll be speaking with us a little bit about the history of farming and how we got from agriculture to industrial agribusiness.
Yes. A lot of people do not see the history behind this, and without the history, you don't understand what this bill is going to do. If you look at it from the point of view of a corporation, you then have a much better understanding of what the intent of the bill is. When you look at the history of our farming from the early 1900s to now, you see that our consolidation. Our corporations have gone from lots of small businesses to a few large businesses. Monsanto, Cargill have bought out hundreds and hundreds of small businesses. Tyson, Purdue Chicken, whoever, they have done vertical integration where they have bought the feed, the chickens, and everything else. The farmer doesn't own the birds. He doesn't even own the houses that the birds are in. The company comes in. They say, hey, will you raise these chickens for us? Farmer says yes, signs a contract. They put up the buildings. His land is collateral for those buildings, so he has a loan with that particular corporation who owns the chickens. They bring in a load of chickens, he raises them using their food, and they come in and they give him X number of cents per bird per pound. And he's stuck because he now has a mortgage on his farm to this corporation. And one of my friends down the street who does this says he hasn't had a raise in like 15 years. Once they've got you, you're stuck. Mm-hmm. And once you're paid off these buildings, the laws change, they're obsolete, and you have to buy another one. So it's not like you can pay it off and then you can start making money. Mm-hmm. We looked into doing it and said, ooh boy, is that bad news? Because you have to literally walk those chickens every 4 hours. You have to go in that building and walk around, take up the dead birds, make sure the birds move around. I'm not saying anything about confinement operations, good or bad, but you have to be very careful. You can't bring disease in. These men who do this don't go anywhere. Their family doesn't go anywhere. They can't come and visit me if I have birds.
So they're being subcontracted?
They're being subcontracted. It's essentially slavery. I mean, once you get into this contract, you're dead. I mean, the company owns you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or you're going to bankrupt and lose your house and your land. So and they've done this with the birds, and they've done it with the hog farm. I think it's like 80% of the hog farmers are now a confinement operation.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with the birds. They have not done it with cattle. The majority of cattle is less than 100 head, and that's your cow-calf operation. Those are your breeders. Your big confinement with your cattle is where they have bought feeder steers, and they're putting them in for finishing operation, where they're taking the calves after they've left their mother, and they put them into a confinement area and grow them up there. But if you look at what's going on, these agribusinesses want complete control. They want, you know, they were very successful in what they did with the hog farmers and the chicken farmers, which means, you know, they control how much money that farmer is getting for his labor. And believe me, they're lucky if they're making 50 cents to a dollar an hour.
And who are some of the corporations that are in this situation?
There's 10 corporations that control most of the food worldwide. Many of them are privately owned. Cargill is one of them. It's a privately owned corporation. They own steamship lines. They own transportation. They own seed elevators, and they trade in seed, or in grains, I should say.
So they're owning the system at every step of the way.
Well, the farmers grow the grain, but the big problem is the farmer has only one person to sell to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So if you only have one customer, that customer can tell you how much they're going to pay for it.
Right.
Okay? That's one of the big problems we have with them having bought up all these other little small companies.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got Cargill. You have ADM, which is publicly held. You've got Bunge, which is privately held. You've got Andre, which is privately held. Monsanto is in the seed part of it. They're not privately held. Toepler is another one, and there's a few others. I can't think of them right off the top of my head, but there's about 10 that control not just the food here, but worldwide. They've got, you know, pretty good stranglehold. And, you know, from the point of view of a corporation, what do you want? You want to make profit.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make profit? Well, you vertically integrate, which means that you own the mine, you own the smelter, the foundry, the fabricator, and the car dealer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you own, and the oil company. You own the whole line. Mm-hmm. So no matter what happens, you own it.
Right.
So you're not having to give any profit to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're seeing happening in agriculture. The other thing you want to do is you want to push your competition out of business. Now, if you're a great big huge corporation like Cargill or Monsanto, you can go in, sell your product for below cost. Now, remember, you've got an advantage already because you're not having to pay. You're vertically integrated. So you can sell below cost.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in these third world countries, in a year or two, you've bankrupted every other small corporation there.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've got all this money behind you. And then you can raise your prices. So that's another way they can make, you know, it's a good business strategy. And the third business strategy is to influence legislation. And let's face it, you look at the amount of money that is given by Monsanto, ADM, Cargill to finance campaigns, and we're talking millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that is a business strategy. And you look at the USDA and the FDA, and you look at the UN Codex Alimentarius, and you look at the World Trade Organization, and it's a revolving door. And this is what you're seeing, is that these corporations have a lot of money, and they have a lot of influence. Now, getting back to our food laws, if you go back to 1987, these big corporations said, hey, let's get together, and we're going to form a group that is going to push for legislation, not in one country. That's a pain in the neck. We want it worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
So they came up with something called the International Policy Council on Agriculture, Food, and Trade, IPC. And it was created in 1987.
And was it the same 10 corporations that you had mentioned before, or?
It was funded by Cargill, Nestle, Kraft, Archer Daniels Middle, that's ADM. The members of it, just to give you an idea, I'm reading this. One of them is Ann Veneman, who was member emeritus, and she was also an employee of Calgene, which was bought by Monsanto, and then she went on. She was part of the negotiating team and for trade for the GATT trade delegation, and then she became USDA Secretary of Agriculture. So,
and what's the GAPT?
GATT is GATT. It's the agreement on trade. Okay, it was the thing that came before the World Trade Organization.
I see.
Okay, so she had been on these World Trade negotiating team.
Mm-hmm.
Another person who was if you want to follow things, follow Dan Amstutz. That man, I hate with a passion because he has ruined farming for farmers. He was a VP of Cargill. He worked for Cargill for 31 years. He worked for Goldman Sachs. He was the one who wrote the agreement on agriculture, the draft.
Mm-hmm.
He also wrote the Freedom to Farm Bill, which was then called the Freedom to Fail Bill because it bankrupted thousands and thousands of farmers in the United States. All the people that have been dying here in the United States from food, tainted food,
mm-hmm.
can thank Mr. Dan Amstutz, because he's the one that changed how we look at food safety. Okay? It used to be that we had the do no harm. Okay? In other words, if something was brought to the FDA or the USDA, it was, you have to prove that it doesn't harm people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they changed that. And it's now measures that do not use quarantine and food safety requirements as unjustifiable trade barriers. We now have to do scientific risk assessment. So we did a complete change on how we look at food safety.
And explain that a little bit more.
Okay. Let me go pick up some more information. There's something called HACCP, which is the HAP regulations. Now, they were actually 1963, I think it was, Pillsbury came up with this system of looking at how things were done. It's based on ISO and Guide to Good Farming Manufacturing Practices. I recognized it as soon as I looked at it.
Is Guide to Good Farming and Agricultural Practices the GAP? Or that's different?
No.
Okay.
No.
GATT, what is
that? GATT is a trade conference.
Oh, no, I meant GAP, Good Agricultural Practices.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay.
Well, acronyms.
Yes, there's an awful lot of acronyms.
And what is the ISO?
Okay, do you know ISO?
No.
Oh, okay. I've lived with it for so long, it's just... ISO is the International Standards Organization.
Okay.
Okay? And they came up with something that was derived from the old good manufacturing practices. Essentially, it's document what you do and do what you documented.
Okay.
Okay. And HACCP follows the same idea. You're going to go into your production facility. You can document everything, lots of paperwork, and you're going to analyze it and figure out where there's a possibility of contamination. That's your critical control point, and then you're going to determine what type of testing you're going to do. The big problem is the USDA turned over the food safety to the corporations instead of having inspectors, and the inspectors are not happy about it, believe me. Instead of having your inspectors look at every single carcass, which is what they did up until 1996, that was our food laws, was we had to have a federal inspector or a state inspector inspect every chicken, every cow, every pig, and look at that body and determine whether there was problems with it.
And at that time, there were enough inspectors to handle this job?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. And then we came up with this hack, and the USDA is closing down testing labs. There's an awful lot. There's also something called when the trade organization came in, their big thing was they wanted to open up borders. They didn't want quarantine or safety requirements to keep them from bringing product in and out across a border.
So one thing that they're thinking here is that food safety is getting in the way of their sales.
Right. Got it in one. They want to get rid of food safety. They want to make it so they have control over it, and they want to get rid of the feds looking at them. That's number one.
And their competition also is somewhere in there.
And they want to get rid of their competition. Well, they've already got these, you know, if you're running a big corporation, you've got to have documentation. You can't run a large corporation without having standards. I've written tons of them. That's what I did for my livelihood, was to go in and do documentation. I've done documentation on entire plants where I've gone in, looked at what people are doing, and writing up standard operating procedures. That's how I made my living, was writing up standard operating procedures, lab procedures, et cetera. So, big corporations have to have them, because if somebody gets sick and dies, you can't have everything in the guy's head.
Right.
Okay? A small family-run farm does not need a standard operating procedure. And that's what they're trying to do. They want standard operating procedures because, let's face it, if you've got standard operating procedures, and I've seen, I used to conduct FDA inspectors on their tours. Don't ask me why I was a pretty young girl, so I got stuck with the FDA inspector. And never once did I see these guys pull a sample and pull the paperwork that went with that sample and see whether or not the lab test was correct. I know for a fact that corporations lie. I have been fired because I refused to falsify data.
And
yeah.
What time period is this? Is this before 96? So even when the inspectors were in place, they weren't doing their job?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Okay? Because what they were doing was pulling samples off shelves and doing testing. Okay? They were coming in, doing the screening, because you can walk through a plant, okay, do we have leaks in the roof, the peanut problem, are they clean, and things like that. So, yes, they can look at the paperwork, they can look at how the plant is running and tell. I never saw them pull samples. But they can then go, and especially when you're dealing with drugs, they go to the grocery stores or whatever, and they'll pull samples.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, no, they were doing that.
Okay.
And you had a lot more inspectors per product. When you're talking about USDA, those inspectors were right there. Okay, that carcass came in. They're going to look at it. Does it have a decent color? Does it smell right? Do I see any lesions? Do I see any pus? Do I see any feces?
Mm-hmm.
you know, they can look at that carcass and tell whether that cow, you know, because they're looking at the cows when they come in.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking at the cow, you know, after it's been skinned. They can tell whether that it's got disease.
Right.
You know, most of the disease you can see by the eyeball.
Mm-hmm.
Plus the fact the USDA used to go and test the animals while they were alive. That's another thing I've got a real problem with. And this is out of the Texas agricultural plan. I can't remember the name of it, which I read. It used to be like in California in 1994, they checked over 10,000 cows for bovine tuberculosis. By 1999, it was down to 1,400 that they were checking. They slashed the number of animals that they were doing disease testing on.
Mm-hmm.
On top of that, the border control at Santa Teresa is turned over to a Mexican Cattlemen's Association, and they're the ones who do the testing to bring the cattle here in the United States. On top of that, the USDA relaxed the standards for bringing those cows over from Mexico, saying, you know, if you've done recent TB testing, then you don't have to do whole herd testing, you can just bring them in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the result is that we are now finding cows at slaughter that have tuberculosis, they have Mexican ear tags, and we now have states with tuberculosis. That's one of the reasons there's been this big hoopla on the raw milk. It used to be there wasn't any tuberculosis here in the United States. Now there is.
And it's coming in through Mexico.
It's coming in through Mexico. It's coming in through Canada. Canada has a reservoir of deer with tuberculosis that are coming over the border and infecting our cows. If there was another one, which is, I think it was brucellosis. Again, the testing was done on the cows. Now, when you're talking about doing a test, you'll get false positives, and sometimes you have to go back and retest. Well, if the cow was at slaughter,
mm-hmm.
you can't go back and test.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go back and test her herd mates. You got to go and figure out who her herd mates are. Whereas if you go in to a dairy farm
mm-hmm.
and you test, you know, 5 out of the 500 cows there, and you come up with a positive, you're going to go back and test all of those 500 cows to see if you've got a real problem.
So,
not doing it anymore.
Does this mean that if you were testing the cows or whatever the animals were while they're alive, then there wouldn't be any kind of a need for being able to trace back because you'd be testing them in time to catch the disease?
Right. The thing is, number one, if you're testing the herd on site, you're going to know whether you've got a disease in that particular herd. If you're testing an animal that is 6 months old instead of 6 years old,
mm-hmm.
then they didn't spend 6 years giving that disease to Lord knows who.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It makes a lot more sense, you know, to test your animals. I mean, I'm a horseman. I lived in apartments most of my life, so I boarded. And most of the boarding stables where I was at had two barns. You had your barn for your horses that stayed home, and you had your show barn.
Mm-hmm.
And your show barn animals were not mixed with your home animals.
Mm-hmm.
Because
to segregate disease.
Segregate disease. If you talk to the people with the heritage breed animals, or you talk to anybody with, you know, a handful of goats or a handful of sheep or whatever, most people learn real quick, you quarantine and you test. Once you get your herd started, you're going to bring in a herd sire, maybe a few females, and you put them in a quarantine pen, you test them for Cassius lymphadenitis and whatever, you know, Coggins and whatever. You make sure that they've got all their vaccinations, they've been wormed, you look at them. I mean, A farmer who doesn't do that is out of business pretty doggone quick, especially if he has gone and bought the animals at auction.
So you want to be sure to be testing the animals while they're still alive before they go to slaughter, because once they go to slaughter, now you're mixing your animals with other farmers' animals, and then there's the possibility that you're contaminating a larger batch.
Right. And the other thing is, you're talking about a computer system. Okay, they have the ear tag, the RFID ear tags in Australia. They've got them in England, and they're going nuts. I think they're chasing, you know, a couple million cows that are phantom cows in the system in England. One of the guys in Australia said that he's got like several hundred cows that he never even bought listed as his.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the computer system, it just doesn't necessarily work. Garbage in, garbage out. They also said that a lot of the ear tags, they have a etched number on them, and then they have the internal read number.
Right.
And the read number and the etched number on 20% of this guy's tags didn't agree.
Incredible.
Yeah. So, you know, there's that problem with the tags. And the big thing is that he's the one that's going to get fined, not the digital angel or whoever sold it to him,
mm-hmm.
for having given him bad tags. It's up to him to do the quality control on the tags,
mm-hmm.
by law. You know, I've got a problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
The big problem is that your large corporate farms do not have to tag. They get one paper number for the entire herd.
So they don't have any kind of a digital tracking?
No. Plus the fact, now this has changed, but originally the people who were going to own the database were the cattle companies. Now, who do you think is going to, if there's a problem, who do you think is going to get nailed with having the diseased cow? The cattle company or some Joe Blow little guy that they're going to...
Or their small competition.
But yeah. I mean, is somebody going to go in and hack the computer system and change the numbers?
Mm-hmm. Well, I just don't think it's a good idea to allow the industry to regulate itself.
And that's what you've got.
Mm-hmm.
Now, getting back to your, I came into this from the NAIS because I had horses. I've had horses all my life. And I looked at that and said, there's no way I'm going to inject one of these little things into the animal's neck. They've been doing it over in Europe, and they've had major problems. It's caused infections. It's caused paralysis. The big problem is the skin is rather loose on that neck, and the thing moves and migrates.
Mm-hmm.
So you think you stuck it in point A, and it's somewhere else in the animal.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can't find it with your reader.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'm not real thrilled with that. If we have to go that route and I have to tag my animals, they're getting a freaking ear tag.
Mm-hmm.
I am not going to take the chance of putting it in their neck.
Mm-hmm. I have another question for you. There's the RFID tag supposedly is to track. What I hear about it is it's to track disease within 48 hours. They can go back and find out which animal had the disease. But aren't animals already tracked in the current system without RFID?
Of course. Let's face it.
Could you explain how that works?
Think about your chicken. Where is your chicken? Cargill or Tyson sold the batch of chickens, didn't sell them, brought that batch of chickens and gave them to Farmer A. They took them from Farmer A and brought them to their processing plant.
Mm-hmm.
What's the track? They knew where the chickens were hatched. They know which farmer got them, and they know which plant processed them. It's already in the system.
Mm-hmm.
Same with the hogs. Okay, cattle. You've got your cow-calf operation, which is, and as I said, anybody who has animals is real picky about bringing new animals in. So if you're going to bring in a breeding bull, you're going to know who he is and who you brought him in, and you're going to do all sorts of testing before you turn him loose on your cows, because you don't want him giving him any disease.
Mm-hmm.
So the farmer is going, hey, my first horse, I can tell you right now, that first horse came from King's Ranch. His daddy was Roman Carnival, and his mom was Lady Tack out of Hard Tack by Man of War. Okay? And that's a horse I bought in 1960.
Wow.
So, you know, farmers know who their animals are. It's not like you're talking about cars. You're not trading them in every two freaking years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to be bringing in your stock, and you're going to be having your daughters, and most farmers are going to know, okay, cow number 67, because most of them have ear tags, gives me a really great animal. I'm going to keep all her daughters.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like cow number 67 because half the time she gives me spindly, weak little animals, and I lose some.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to get rid of her, and I'm going to get rid of all of her daughters. If you're in trying to make money, you're going to keep track of your animals, so you know your animals.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have some sort of paperwork system or in your head, like I do, if you have a good memory. So you know your animals. You're not going to be bringing, you know, it's not like kids in a kindergarten where you move 10 times in 20 years and the kid's going from school to school to and things like that. No, these animals come in, they're on the farm, and they stay on their farm until they go to slaughter.
Now, what kind of tracking is there between the farm and the slaughter so they know which farmer brought what animals?
If you take an animal to auction, the auction house tags that animal with an ear tag, and your name and address are attached to that ear tag. Right there.
And that's written on, that's not a digital system.
It's not a it's a digital system in that they...
It's a barcode?
They put it into a computer. Mm-hmm. You know, you got tag 875-R15 or whatever,
mm-hmm.
And your name and address,
mm-hmm.
because you're going to get paid for that cow when it gets sold. Of course they're going to have tracking. They have, you know, you unload your cow or your sheep or goat or pig or whatever. It gets a number. You go home. The animal's sold, and they cut you a check.
Mm-hmm. So
they know who it was. And the same when you go to a slaughterhouse. Okay? I take a bunch of animals to a slaughterhouse. They're going to know. Because, you know, they're going to have to pay me. So there's paperwork there. I'm sorry. There's paperwork there.
Is anyone right now claiming that there is a problem with the tracking of the animals as the system exists now?
The only people who are claiming a problem with tracking is the USDA.
And the USDA is the organization that used to have enough inspectors, but now is understaffed.
They're understaffed because they're spending money on trying to shove NAIS down our throats. They spent, $138 million in trying to get farmers to accept the tracking.
Mm-hmm.
Bribes to Indian tribes, bribes to states, bribes to breed associations, even $10 to a 4-H kid to get them to sign their parents' property up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're talking freaking bribes when you give $10 to a kid to sign up their parents' property on a premises ID.
Mm-hmm.
That did not go over well with the farmers, believe me.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of doing what they're supposed to do, which is check the food that's coming over our borders. And I think that we've got like 1.5 FDA inspectors per port to check the food coming from China and all over the place.
Now, did we used to have more inspectors for this job, or we had less food coming over the borders?
Much less food. Because remember, they opened the borders with this free trade agreement.
So this goes back to the free trade agreement.
Yes. What the free trade agreement did was get rid of tariffs, and it opened our borders so that the food was not being quarantined and tested before it could come in.
That's incredible.
Yeah. That's why I wanted to go around on the background, because most people don't understand why we have a food safety problem, and it all goes back to the World Trade Organization's Agreement on Agriculture. The FDA even said point blank, we have to change how we're doing it because we will have fines and sanctions if we don't harmonize our laws with the international laws that are being propagated by the World Trade Organization, which is being run by big international corporations.
So basically, we have international corporations getting together to make laws and regulations
and imposing them on all the governments in the world that have agreed to World Trade Organization.
And so we've got private industries creating regulations that they're asking governments to agree to, and this is bypassing democracy.
Oh, yeah. It's even worse than that. The European Union doesn't allow genetically modified organisms.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the United States went in and through the World Trade Organization and said, you're going to have to let in Monsanto.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, no. So there was a trial. Now, the way the World Trade Organization works is you don't know who the judges are. You don't know when it happened or where it happened. And you still there?
Yes.
And all the proceeds are secret. Okay? So it's completely blind. You've got three, and these at least...
I'm sorry, four, three what?
Three judges, arbitrators, whatever you want to call them, who look at the information and make a determination.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there has been a lot of scientific evidence that genetically modified organisms, number one, your corn cross-pollinates with your natural breeds, so it contaminates.
Mm-hmm.
The BT gene looks like it's causing problems with your honeybees.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought that the gene was not absorbed into the through the gut, but it is absorbed.
Mm-hmm.
That you get these DNA chains that are then being incorporated into the person or the animal's body.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's data there saying, hey, you know, we've got some major questions here about whether this stuff is actually safe. Also, some of the stuff causes major allergy problems. So there's scientific evidence out there that says, wait a second, we really need to look at this. This is called the precautionary principle. That's what we used to use. That's your do no harm precautionary principle. It's the principle that the United Nations uses when they're looking at the environment. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
If we think there might be a problem, we take action. Okay, precautionary principle. Do no harm.
Mm-hmm.
World Trade Organization, point blank, it was a speech in 2001, said the precautionary principle is completely unscientific and therefore cannot be used as a reason to stop genetic modified organisms from coming into a country.
Mm-hmm.
So they had this trial. All of this scientific evidence saying that there's reason to doubt whether the genetic modified organisms are safe.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know what scientific evidence was brought up. You have no idea of what happened, but these judges said, sorry, European Union, we're hitting you with trade sanctions and fines and everything else. So they're having to pay millions and billions of dollars to keep the GMO out of Europe.
And who else, you know, how do they allow these things to be enforced? Well, you know, what, where?
You signed up on the treaty.
Okay, so once you sign the treaty, then you, it's like you forfeit your country's
sovereignty.
Right. Yeah.
And it's not only that. Your GATT, your old treaties. Yeah, it was Agreement on Trades and Tariffs. General Agreement on Trades and Tariffs. They had no teeth. The World Trade Organization has trade sanctions. In other words, they can say, we will not trade with you. They can literally starve you out.
So if you didn't agree as a country to pay your fines, if let's say the European Union decided we don't want genetically engineered food, they're going to fine us, we're not going to pay the fine, then the WTO could impose trade sanctions on them?
Yep.
That sounds fine by me.
You know, in other words, you know, you're not going to be allowed to export anything or import anything.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they've got, you know, large economic pressure there. And that's why the FDA is sitting there saying, well, we're going to have to use these Codex Alimentarius rules and all of these international rules. We're going to have to use them here in the United States. We didn't vote on them. We don't want them. The organic groups and the people who like herbs and people who want to take vitamins and things like that are going absolutely ballistic about it because I think it's in December of this year, Codex is going to kick in, and I'm not up on this, so this is just a rumor, but I think you're not going to be able to buy vitamins because Codex has decided that they are toxic. And they have instead of having a minimum daily requirement, they have a maximum daily requirement. So you're not allowed to put in or have any type of stuff that's beyond what used to be our minimum daily requirement.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to see vitamin D in your milk anymore or vitamin C in your orange or in your fruit juices and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So getting back to the violating the trade agreements, it seems like it'd be a good thing for any of these countries to refuse to participate and be sanctioned because at least then you would retain your sovereignty. And the things I've been hearing about from other people about oil running out and things like that, it makes more sense for us to keep our food in our own countries.
Oh, that's the other thing. You know, they're talking about exporting. We need the ear tagging, RFID tagging for export. Number one, that's a fallacy. I mean, Australia did all the tagging, and the United States still sells more beef worldwide than Australia did, and Australia and England, et cetera, have, and the European Union, have been doing tagging since 2000, okay, 8 years. They don't have a trade advantage. We're selling more than they are. Ours has increased, theirs has decreased.
Hmm.
The second thing is we import twice as much beef as we export.
Hmm.
What's worse is countries we are importing from have mad cow disease, bovine tuberculosis, blue tongue, all sorts of diseases. You take a look at Nigeria and Brazil and Argentina and Mexico and the BSE, mad cow disease, up in Canada,
mm-hmm.
and you look at what we've got here in the United States. Our herds are fairly clean. I don't want them bringing live cattle down from Canada or up from Mexico.
And does that have to do with the North American Alliance, the
North American Trade Alliance and also World Trade Organization, both of them.
So that is the reason that we see more
diseases coming across our border.
Well, the allowance of more animals to cross the border and the diseases coming with that.
Right. And to give you an idea of how nasty this stuff is, England knew, and I don't have the dates right off the top of my head, England was aware of the fact that feeding bone meal and, you know, cow parts.
Cow byproducts.
Cow byproducts to cattle was implicated in mad cow disease.
Mm-hmm.
So they passed a law in their country, you couldn't put these byproducts into feed.
Mm-hmm.
They've got all these byproducts. What are they going to do to them? They exported them.
Wow.
Okay. Came up on the Warmwell site. So somebody in England said, well, you know, what, you're exporting stuff knowing that it's a problem. What did you do? We told, you know, we told one of, I don't know if it was Codex or whoever, because they didn't say, or the World Trade Organization, but they had told one of the world organizations that there was the problem, etc. And the United States Department of Agriculture allowed that material to come into this country. We imported over 100 cows from England during that time period, and a lot of this bone meal, which was then put into our cattle feed.
Mm.
And it was done in Canada, too. That's where your bovine BSE is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's one of the reasons that they will not allow testing here in the United States. They know we have the disease. They know that we imported it. They know that we brought it in the feed. And on the BSE, do you know about Creekstone Farms wanted to do 100% testing on their animals?
I heard that a farm wanted to do that, yeah.
Yeah, that was Creekstone. They wanted to do 100% testing for mad cow disease. They had the laboratory all set up, the people trained and everything. All they had to do was get the test kits. And the United States Department of Agriculture said no. They said no because they said, you know, if you have a false positive, it'll cause an alarm. Well, it's very easy. We do drug testing on humans, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a good chance you may have a false positive. So there is already a written procedure to deal with false positives. And remember, this mad cow disease can't be killed by cooking. So if you can't kill it by cooking or irradiation, mm-hmm. then that stuff's going to stick around. All you've got to do is take a sample and hang on to it, put it in the fridge or the freezer.
Mm-hmm.
You do your testing. If you come up with a positive, then you take that sample and you ship it to a USDA lab to have it confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, the reason they give on a, you know, false positive causing a problem makes absolutely zero sense. I've run labs. If we had a positive, you confirm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is typical lab procedure, especially when you're dealing with something like this. You know, you're not going to throw out a huge batch of material based on a test. You're going to go and you're going to confirm that that test was good.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else?
I've got, my question is, the USDA, I heard in the news that we don't have enough people working at the USDA to ensure us that we're going to have food safety. And now, is that just a result of how the laws changed in, was it 84 or 96?
It was in 96. Part of it is because of the way the laws changed, and part of it is because we have so much food that's coming across the border. We have, you know, increased the import horrendously. You know, and you're talking about having to inspect all of the fruits and vegetables as well as everything else coming in from China and coming in from Mexico. And you know, I'm sorry, I'm not real thrilled about eating those foods without having them checked.
But there's not a there's not more demand for food coming from outside the country. This is only mandated by the trade agreement, correct?
I haven't really followed anything except the cattle, and like I said, we export half the number of cows that we import. So, you know, why the heck are we going back and forth across the border unless it's advantageous to a corporation?
Right, that doesn't make any sense, especially in the energy to
transport. Yes,
transport. Yeah,
and you know, we have Florida, we have California. Yes, we need to import food, but I don't see that our population has grown tremendously since 1995. And we weren't having the food problems back in the early 90s. It's only been recently. So it all goes back to that World Trade Organization. And also, if, you know, talking about population, because population is now becoming a big thing. Oh my God, we've got too many people here and everything. Mm-hmm. If you look at Europe and you look at the United States, our population growth is about zero. The reason you're seeing a lot more people here is because of immigration. That is nothing against the Mexicans or anyone else coming into this country, because, let's face it, they're the ones that do our farm labor. But the reason we have the immigration is because we have very, very slow population growth.
But a big reason for the immigration is because of the free trade agreements, because it's making it unprofitable for farmers to remain in Mexico farming.
Oh, yeah. I mean, thousands and thousands of them have been bankrupted, so they have no choice but to come here.
I'm seeing a common thread here in all of our problems. They're coming from the trade organization.
Bingo. You've got it. And that's why I wanted to give the background, because unless you look at the whole picture, you don't understand. And then when you look at H.R. 875 and you slide that into as a small part of the picture, you go, oh, these guys are going to put lots of red tape on our farmers and push them out of business. It's already been done. Remember, we're talking about harmonized laws. That means that the laws here in the United States have to match the laws all over the rest of the world. European Union has already put in laws that are approved by the World Trade Organization.
Mm-hmm.
Those rules, Sir Julian Rose was at a meeting in Brussels, and it was about the agricultural terms for bringing Poland into the European Union. And they said point blank, we're going to remove 1 million farmers from their land. And he said, Poland has 20% unemployment. What are they going to do? And they said, well, we don't really care about that. We're going to remove them from their land, and we're going to modernize, industrialize the farming there.
Mm-hmm.
And some other lady from Portugal piped up and said, yes, we've removed 60% of our farmers. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That there. And as Sir Julian Rose said, the way they're doing it is with red tape.
Mm.
So you look at what happened in Europe, and you can see exactly what they're planning on doing here, because they're going to harmonize. And Bush point blank said, we will harmonize our rules with European Union.
Mm-hmm. So this is a little more than speculation, because we can see other people who are going down this road and see what the effects are.
With the exact same laws.
Right.
You know, so it's not speculation. That's why I wanted to give the history, because it's not speculation. We can see it. And then if you want to put another block in the building, you've got moving the Plum Island foot and mouth disease laboratories into the middle of Kansas with all the cows. Excuse me? Why are you moving a lab with... Do you know anything about foot and mouth disease?
No.
Okay. Foot and mouth disease is extremely contagious. That's why they did the quarantining they did in England. A human being will breathe in the foot and mouth disease and is contagious to a cow for 48 hours. In other words, USDA agent can go from farm to farm and infect every single farm if they're doing their rounds. Okay, very, very contagious. The foot and mouth disease that devastated England in 2001, that was leaked from Perbright Laboratories. They found that it had leaked out of the building.
And is that an English corporation?
That is a government laboratory, disease testing laboratory.
In our country or their country?
In England.
Okay.
Okay, so Perbright Laboratories in England was the source of the foot and mouth disease. There's something called the OIE, return to disease-free status. Again, World Trade Organization, UN, FAO, OIE, came up with these rules. If you're talking about, and it's different for different types of diseases, if you're talking about foot and mouth disease, if you go and you stamp out, in other words, you kill, slaughter, all of the animals that have the disease and all of the animals within a 10 kilometer radius, 6 mile radius, around that disease, that's stamping out, and then wait 3 months and there is no more disease, you can resume trade. If you use vaccination, you may not resume trade for 2 years.
Wow.
That is why England did not use vaccination. Perbright Laboratories had the vaccine. It was sitting right in the neighborhood. The vaccine was there, and they did not use it. They killed billions of animals, devastated their economy, doing the stamping out because of World Trade Organization rules, OIE rules. Goes right back to it. Because they've had foot and mouth disease in England before. It was there, I think in the 60s, 70, in 1978. And what did they do? They used vaccine. They used testing, and they used vaccine. And they buried on the property. Okay? And with QuickPoint. Okay? So what they did was they went in, found the disease, killed the animals that had the disease, buried them, and then they vaccinated the surrounding area. They got rid of it without a problem. Okay, so they knew how to take care of the disease. A vet who had actually gone through it was there and was trying to give them how to handle it, and instead they went with what Brussels told them to do and the OIE told them to do, which was to kill all the animals instead of vaccinating.
All right, let's hang on one moment while I tell the listeners you're listening to WHCL-FM, Clinton, New York. If you have any questions, you want to reach us here in the studio, we're broadcasting live. The phone number here is area code 315-859-4200. That's 315-859-4200. I'd like to ask you, what kind of incentives does the World Trade Organization give to a country to persuade them to give up their sovereignty? Or is this something that you haven't followed? I mean, I know that's a different question than the rest of...
I haven't really followed that. I know that if you go back even further, the World Bank and IMF had something called the Structural Adjustment Program, SAPs, and a lot of the third world countries were having problems making their payments on international loans. So the World Bank came in and said, okay, we will redo your loans, but, and I love these buts, we're going to tell you how to run your country. And part of it was you're going to have to export food, And another one is you're going to have to cut out your support programs for your farmers. And there was a lot of other stuff, too. But those two things caused major problems in third world countries. And that's what's happened in Mexico and a lot of your African countries. They came in and said, you know, you can no longer give aid to your farmers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want to modernize your farming. We're going to bring in, you know, corporate farming. And you're going to make money to pay us by, you know, taking your good farmland and use it for, you know, growing coffee or tea or cocoa or whatever, you know, export cotton, and export it and then use that money. But you can't do it with your little farmers, so you're going to have to get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this has been going on. I just started with the World Trade Organization, but it's been going on for longer than that.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about the E. coli? Now, is that something that is coming from cattle being corn-fed, to your knowledge?
I really haven't. As far as the E. coli goes, part of the problem is you're keeping a lot of animals in a small area. And whenever you do that, your chances of disease increases.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have the chance of the disease increase, they put antibiotics in the feed.
Mm-hmm.
And once you start putting antibiotics in the feed, you get a kill-off, and then a few of the bacteria survive, and those are the ones that are going to propagate. So you're going to have mutations happening and things like that. That's just my science background.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the E. coli goes, you heard about in North Carolina they had the petting farm and the E. coli.
No, I hadn't heard of that.
Okay, that was back, when was that, Peter? 2004, yeah, I think it was around 2004, the state fair. I happen to know the guy.
Mm-hmm.
What was very interesting about that, and this is bringing it back to the USDA, is he did the county fair here in my county. He was here for over a week. We had no disease, no problems, because I talked to the manager of the fair, and I said, hey, did you have anybody complain of tummy upsets,
mm-hmm.
you know, from the petting farm? And he said, no. And this is talking to him a couple months later. He went home. The United States Department of Agriculture had changed the regulations due to the Animal Welfare Act, and they came in and checked his animals before they could go to the fair. That means they took a thermometer and stuck it up the butt of every single one of his animals.
Mm-hmm.
This is the United States Department of Agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
He go, and this was, our fair was 1 week. There was a week, you know, he had like 5 days, and then he had the state fair. So we're talking, you know, pretty close timing. He, no problems during my county fair.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I don't know if it was 2 weeks or a week, then he goes to the state fair, and you get all these people sick.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what happened? He went home. He didn't go anywhere else between my fair and the state fair. The only thing that happened was the United States Department of Agriculture employee came on the property and touched his animals. Where was that person beforehand?
Mm-hmm.
What was the person doing beforehand? She or he was probably checking cows. He told me that CDC, the Center for Disease Control lab guy, said it was the first time they'd ever seen the E. coli in sheep and goats.
Mm-hmm.
And this is from a conversation I had with the guy during the time period. And he's saying they didn't know how it got into the sheep and goats. Well, you had somebody who was checking cows come onto the property and stick, you know, handle his animals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't know if that's where it came from, but I do know that there was no problem. He never had a problem with the E. coli, and I mean, this man does fairs and festivals and big ones year-round, and he's been in business for years and years and years, or had been, and all of a sudden he's got a problem, and the only time he had the problem was after the USDA had their hands all over his animals.
Mm-hmm.
So and by the way, that particular USDA agent is an animal rights activist. I looked her up.
Did you hear the story of Ronnie Cummins and the mad sheep?
The Fallis.
From mm-hmm. Organic Consumers?
Linda Fallis.
Okay.
Mad sheep. Yes.
And that the FDA came and killed all their
that
sheep?
That was the USDA came in and killed all the sheep because they said that they thought that they tried to prove that scrapies in sheep and goats was the reason for mad cow disease. They're similar diseases, but they have never been able to prove, and they've tried like crazy, to prove that mad cow disease came from sheep.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done some reading on that. They brought the animals in from Europe. The animals were checked, quarantined, and everything else came in. Now, when you're dealing with animals like that, you're going to have half of your lambs are going to be male. So all of the male lambs that went to slaughter were tested for scrapies, came out negative. All of your, this was like 6 years after they had imported. Well, at 6 years, those imported animals are probably going to be to the point where they're going to be getting rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not real clear on milking sheep, but on milking cows, my ex-father-in-law used to do milking, and 6 years is the age when you get rid of the animals. So they'd already probably turned over the original animals, or a lot of them,
mm-hmm.
and had already had them all tested. And, you know, they had 5 years of negative. And scrapies disease will go through a herd. Okay, it's contagious from one animal to another.
Mm-hmm.
So if there was scrapies in her herd, with 5 years of testing, 50% of the lambs being born, you should have seen it.
Right.
Okay? And if they did think there was a problem, you've got the original animals are sitting there, either they've been tested or they're alive there. You take the original animals and you test them. If there's no scrapies or anything else in the original animals, then there's no reason to kill all the herd.
Mm-hmm.
So from a scientific point of view, it made no sense. Why are you taking the entire herd? There was no reason to.
Right.
If you thought there was a problem, you take the original animals, kill them, and test them. Because scrapies and BSE has to be done, it's like rabies. You've got to get the brain. You can't do a testing from just blood or a biopsy.
Mm-hmm.
But that made absolutely no sense. And have you heard the Henshaw pig slaughter?
No.
Oh, that one was real nasty. This is up in Virginia. They claimed that he had pseudo-rabies in his animals. Number one, pseudo-rabies does not kill the animal. It's not contagious to humans. It's difficult to test for because you have to take the sample and test immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They came in and they killed all of his animals. The normal procedure for pseudo-rabies is to do what I said, do some testing, and then the farmer is asked to send all of his animals to slaughter, and the animals are just sold off for slaughter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's no reason to go in and kill all of his animals. They are perfectly acceptable to eat. Okay, so he could have had the animals, you know, sold off for slaughter. Number two, with pseudo-rabies, it affects the piglets. It causes abortion, the piglets are listless, et cetera, et cetera. There was no problems with the piglets. They couldn't catch the piglets. They were so fast.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, they came at like 5 o'clock in the morning or 5:30 in the morning, and they held these people at gunpoint for over a week. I think it was 10 days to 2 weeks. They held them on house arrest at gunpoint for a couple of weeks. They had brought a warrant against Danny for having what he had was a mammalian hunting enclosure, but he was doing it with Russian boar pigs. The law was for deer and wildlife. It was not for pigs, which is a domesticated species. So the law that they were, that they hit him with was not correct. And they fined him. He had to pay the salaries of all these people, the cleanup and everything else. And his lawyer, I love his lawyer, afterwards looked at it and said, oh, this doesn't apply. Yeah, great lawyer. But that's the type of thing that's been going on. Co-op had had the same thing. A guy came home to find his wife and little girls being held at gunpoint. And they were held at gunpoint for several hours. They came in, they took his computer and every single piece of food in his house. Not the co-op food. All of his food. You know? And his computers, all of his computer disks, you know, files and everything else. Farmers are not real happy about it. The guy that I talked to, I mentioned that had the falling out with the USDA and got nailed with the E. coli. When they came to inspect, they went through his refrigerator and his medicine cabinets, came right into his house and went through his medicine cabinets and his refrigerator. The other people with petting farms have said that they have gotten fined because they weren't on their property. The United States Department of Agriculture says the person who holds the license will be on that property during business hours if you are not for a surprise inspection. If you are not on that property, you must call the United States Department of Agriculture and let them know when you're off your property. We don't do that to sex offenders.
This stuff's outrageous.
Yes, it is.
What kind of is there a place that listeners can go to research more on these kind of stories? Or
wait one second.
Sure.
I'm going to have to bring that up on my computer. There's a bunch of us who are going to be trying to put up a website that has the documentation. Okay.
And also, did you hear about, is it Wisconsin that's attempting to do on-premise ID and suing farmers over it right now?
Yes. Yes.
Could you speak a little bit about
premises
that?
Premises ID, the USDA is using something called premises ID and stakeholder. And premises has international connotation, okay? A premise in the world criminal court, a premises has no property rights attached to it. Okay, remember, we're going back to the World Trade Organization. We're going into trade. In other words, a farmer who owns a cow-calf operation sells his steers to a feed operation. That feed operation gets sued by the European Union for having BSE or whatever. And they say, well, the cows came from that guy. He can lose his property through the International Criminal Court because he has no property rights. And your premises ID is not property. It essentially conveys a property rights to the United States Department of Agriculture. And the other word is stakeholder. A stakeholder, you become... they talk about farmers as being stakeholders. A stakeholder is a third party that is in possession of property that is owned by someone else. Okay, so the use of premises and the use of stakeholder throws a huge alert to anybody who does any looking at this sort of stuff. It's not good.
So they're attempting to set up a legal way of stealing the property out from the farmer, or...
Yep.
Okay.
Because if you look at H.R. 875, we're talking of fines up to $1 million a day. Okay? If you look at exactly... people have said, well, you know, it's not a real big deal, you know, because they're not going to be able to enforce it. It doesn't work that way. If you look at H.R. 875, number one, the funds that are taken from the farmer, or if they take the land and sell it, all those funds go into an account which is available to who the food czar is what we call them, the food czar for use. In other words, he can use that to hire more agents. Okay, number two, the food czar cannot be, is the supreme being, okay? You cannot sue him, you cannot do anything. His word is law.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, if a farmer, if they come in and they hit you with a fine and you say, hey, you know, that's ridiculous, you're doing this because you're trying to take my farm away from me. So you have 30 days to go to court.
Mm-hmm.
If you do go to court, you have to have a preponderance of evidence to overturn USDA ruling. In other words, the farmer is guilty unless he can prove that the USDA is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to have a lot of information to show they're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, the USDA or the food czar, whatever, or FDA, USDA, FDA combined, will have complete and utter power over the farmers, and the farmers will be left with zero recourse.
Where in the bill does it talk about the $1 million a day fine?
Let me pull that up.
Because I went to govtrack.us, and I've got the text of H.R. 875, Food Safety Modernization, and I'm trying to do search the page for the word million.
Okay.
And I'm not finding it. Sorry, I'm asking you all these, throwing you in all different directions all at once here.
Okay, I don't have... I have the thing on the administrator, which I've got copied. It says, the administrator, in order to protect the public health, shall establish a national traceability system that enables the administrator to retrieve the history, use, and location of an article of food through all stages of its production, processing, and distribution. What's real scary about that is that in 1995, USDA Food Safety and Inspection Service presented a 600-page document, Farm to Table, Control of Every Step in the Food Chain from Production to Home Preparation. So, you know, you look at that and go, whoops. Let me see if I can find that.
I mean, everything that I see here says about fines says fined in accordance with Title 18, the United States Code, or both. I don't know what Title 18 is.
Now, they may have changed it.
I can look into this more and speak about my findings in a future program.
Yeah, if you've got an email, you can give it address, you can give it to me a little bit later. But the original bill definitely did have $1 million a day, and if there was any deaths, up to 10 years in jail.
Hmm.
But Nat, when we were talking about the NAIS, all of the information about it got deleted. and the only information left was stuff that was on, that somebody had copied and put onto their own blog.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you've got to be careful, because they do change things.
Mm-hmm.
It's very frustrating for us.
Yeah, sounds like it would be. Let's see, I had a few more questions for you, and they're escaping me right now. How about resources for the listeners?
Okay, let me go back to that. We're just going to set that plug up, and now I've got to find it.
Not a problem.
Okay. There's so much information, it's tough to have all of it at my fingertips.
I'd say it's a lot of information to cover.
Oh, yes. And there's been a whole bunch of us working on this. This is not just me by any stretch of the imagination.
Do you have anything to say about H.R. 759?
I've just been working on this one. I mean, I know there's several bills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a matter of fact, it's been a real horror story for anybody, because you're talking about corporations that have thousands of people. Lawyers, lobbyists, and everything. And then there's us, and, you know, we're doing whatever work we do and trying to do this too. So it's very much a David and Goliath type of situation.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, they've got all of the brains, they've got all the money, and they've got tons of people.
Mm-hmm.
And even worse, they've had years and years to do the preparation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we're finding that some of the people we thought would be on board and on our side are not.
Mm-hmm.
One of the board of directors of Organic Consumer, for one thing, she's Canadian, and for another thing, she's now the advisor to a senior advisor to the UN. She's not interested in rocking the boat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so she's switched sides on us, and it's been real, real problem for us.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Another question I have for you is, all these different outbreaks that we're hearing about of contamination of peanut butter and contamination of pistachio nuts and spinach and peppers or tomatoes or whatever that was, why are we hearing about so many of these things right now? Do you have any speculation as to...
Well, for one thing, one of the corporations and Time Warner are connected. And this is my own personal experience. Okay, it has nothing to do with food. Do you remember, oh Lord, it had to be maybe 20 years ago, there was the polystyrene scare.
I don't recall what exactly it was about.
Okay, somebody, it hit all of the newspapers all over the country that polystyrene was a major pollutant. Freon was used for making foamed polystyrene.
Mm-hmm.
and all sorts of other things.
I do recall that, yeah.
Okay. Now, that was a real interesting situation, because I was on the inside of that one. My boss was one of the engineers, actually he was one of the negotiators. You had the company I was working with, Sweetheart Plastics, and McDonald's. And they were going to form a company that was going to do post-consumer recycling of polystyrene used at McDonald's plants.
I remember going to McDonald's as a young person and
it was all styrene.
Seeing the recycling garbage bin for their styrofoam Big Mac containers.
Right. Well, your utensils, your bottles, your styrofoam clamshells, all of it, you know, practically all of it except for the food was going to be polystyrene.
Mm-hmm.
And polystyrene is very, very easily recycled.
Mm-hmm.
They had bought the land in Leominster, Massachusetts, and they were going to do this recycling. They were going to use handicapped workers. They were going to set it up so that it could, that the people who would be doing it would be handicapped. It was a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
And 1 month before the television ads were to, they hit with this polystyrene is evil. And I will tell you, all of the points that were made in the newspaper were wrong, because I worked in that field.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no love for that company, so I'm not protecting the company. I don't work for them, haven't worked for them in 15 years. It was attributed to a school teacher in New Hampshire. Now, how the heck did a school teacher in New Hampshire get all of the newspapers around the country to lambaste polystyrene?
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me? We're trying to, you know, there's several of us throughout the United States, and we can't get to square one on something that's directly affecting our food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sorry, most of the media is controlled by large corporations. An excellent example is Derry Brownfield. Derry Brownfield said some pretty nasty things about Monsanto. He was kicked off the air.
Mm-hmm.
The National Animal Identification System. There are some people on, I'm not sure which TV channel, that do things on how to train horses. They have never said a word about it. Somebody who knew them asked them why, and they said, we were told, warned, if we said a thing, we'd be kicked off the air.
Well, Cheryl, I'm going to have you on the radio again, because we've run out of time. Our next DJ has come in.
Okay.
I'll give you a call and get links for the listeners, and I'll post them on the website where the show can be downloaded.
Okay.
So I thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thank you very much for talking to me.
And hopefully we'll be speaking again.
Okay, bye.
Bye. All right, and thank you for listening. Please tune in again. Please tune in again next week at 8 o'clock Wednesday, and you can find us at radioforall.net and search for The Ringer with a W, radio, the number 4, all, .net, and The Ringer with a W. Thank you.